You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 20th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, to celebrate, recognize Juneteenth, Professor Robin D.G. Kelly will be joining us. Also on the program today, for the first time ever, leftist wins in Colombia. As Gustavo Petro beats out a tycoon mayor en France. Mélenchon's left party tops Macron centrist, but it's Le Pen's coalition that is on the move.
Not good.
Meanwhile, in Texas, Republicans agree on a platform saying that Donald Trump won the 2020 elections, in addition to basically outlawing gay people. Pfizer, Moderna, COVID shots are now available for children 6 months to 4 years old. And in Maryland, the first Apple store ever has now unionized, or at least in this country. Oh, also on the program, Iowa Supreme Court overturns Iowa Constitution and says abortion rights are unprotected. This is 2 years after the Iowa Republicans court packed. It's doable, folks. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin to stop scheduling abortions this week in anticipation of the federal Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. Yellowstone National Park devastated by flooding. Montana also. Floods in India and Bangladesh leave millions homeless. FINA, the International Federation of Swimming, says trans women who experience male puberty cannot compete in women's swimming events. And 6 in 10 Americans say Trump should be prosecuted for January 6th. 60%. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us. It is the beginning of the week that is also known as Monday. Joining me, of course, as always, except for last Friday, Emma Vigeland.
And Wednesday of this week through so I'm off starting Wednesday for a week.
All right. Well, Sorry. There you go, folks. You've been fair warned.
Yes.
You have been fair warned.
Enjoy me while you can.
That's right. Everything is fleeting, ladies and gentlemen, at least in terms of Emma's presence this week.
Yes.
Only this week. We got a lot to get to. There is one of the big sort of, thought pieces we're reading now is how hard it is for Merrick Garland to bring any type of prosecutions. Now, we should say, this just reminds me of how hard it was for Eric Holder to bring any prosecutions with bankers at the time, because too big to fail. I mean, the idea is that you steal a lot, they make you king, steal a little, they put you in jail. And we're in an era, and we've been in that era now for you know, 15 years. We had Lanny Breuer and Eric Holder basically saying in public, look, we cannot prosecute the CEOs of these banks or these insurance companies or whoever it was that perpetrated frauds and broke our securities laws and had our issued fake mortgages or or failed in their fiduciary duties. We can't prosecute them because if we do, you know, a lot of people could lose their jobs or their, you know, their companies could go under. And they would articulate this publicly. And
so now we're from too big to fail to too Republican to jail.
Nice. Right. I mean, but it's not just that they're Republican, although the reality is, let's not kid ourselves. Trump's DOJ will.
Oh, yeah.
Trump's DOJ will.
Or we're too cowardly to jail them.
It is. There is a you know, I think we had was it Eisinger on the program who had written a book.
Chicken Shit Club.
Yes. And that's basically what we're looking at. I mean, the irony is that under Trump, prosecutions of white collar criminals even dropped even more. But that was because they weren't interested in making that illegal anymore. But that's where we are. And it is the Democrats continue to relentlessly hope that aliens are going to come from a different planet and fix everything. That seems to be the strategy. That somehow the fever is going to break that we have, I mean, for decades now. And you can see what's coming out of Texas and their platform. And I will tell you, if you go back, and I went and I watched some of the video I did, the documentary, when I went to the RNC in 2004. I just watched like 5 or 10 minutes of it because I went to the Texas people. We're talking about gay people in Texas, and I interviewed a log cabin Republican. We're going to talk about how log cabin Republicans now have been excised from the party in Texas. We will talk about all this. But 15, 16 years ago, I would read the Texas platform, the Republicans, and people would just be like, that's an outlier. That is the last vestige of the party. And now it's quite clear they are not the outliers of they are the vanguard of the party.
The alpha males are back.
The alpha males are back. But the point is they've never left. This has been apparent for over a decade, for 2 decades now. And so much of our media and the Democratic Party, and I really do think, you know, largely a generational thing, but also, you know, may cross-reference also with some other politics. Just completely sort of just shocked at the Republican Party. I wrote a book in 2006 that I feel like I could release that book again. Change a couple of names, everything the same. That's how long this stuff has been going around. And so the Democrats need to do something.
It also undercuts their message significantly when they talk about the existential threat to democracy. And then they're like, but we're a little too afraid to do anything about
it. Well, it's even worse than that. There's an existential threat to democracy. But these guys are reasonable to negotiate with about guns. These guys are reasonable enough to negotiate about whatever it is.
And they keep whittling down the group of people that should be held accountable for January 6th, for example, right? Like the more they include the Bill Barr, Mike Pence into the people, the group of people that were sane enough to stand up to Donald Trump, as opposed to emphasizing the complicity up until the point where it only broke for them because it was untenable for them personally at that point. instead of making that the emphasis, then they're also not making it about the Republican Party.
Exactly. And we're going to hear this later in the program about Clarence Thomas and this and that. So there is an existential threat to democracy, but it only comes from like three people.
Odd.
That's weird.
And the riffraff and the people that stormed the Capitol, not the people that incited it. Don't look up, look down. I mean, not to say that, you know, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers all deserve to be punished for this 100%. But the emphasis should be on the Republican
right.
Party
They're not
writ large.
Growing yeah. in a vacuum. If yeah. the Republican Party was not a problem, the Proud Boys would not be an existential threat to democracy.
Right.
The existential threat to democracy is the Republican Party. It is an institution now that is, whether their hearts are into it or not, that are hell-bent on both reversing individual liberties and undercutting our democracy. That's just the bottom line. And the Democratic Party needs to act and articulate that as if that's the case. You cannot just whine that people don't understand that it's an existential threat to democracy, but also we need bipartisanship. Like, I'm sorry. It's just these two things cannot exist in the same moment and place. They can't. They cannot. All right, here is, well, you know, we don't have time for these videos. We'll play those later.
It's fine. The rant, this was a sufficient segment.
That was,
I guess. Yeah, I would say.
Folks, we're going to, a couple words from our sponsors, and then Professor Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of American history at UCLA, will be joining us to talk about Juneteenth. I really feel like we should have pre-taped and gone on vacation. I mean, taken the day off. Well, I'll talk about that in a minute, because I walking down here today on Flyby, it was like,
it's odd that like everyone I know has Juneteenth off and this show doesn't have Juneteenth
my
off.
Still, my feeling is that people still don't, you know,
no, I'm joking.
Weren't aware of the holiday or what it's about. But I also have some questions about the holiday, too. And that's why we're doing this next year.
Also, it slipped my mind because Juneteenth was on Sunday. So I think that's maybe why we forgot.
No, I knew it was. I made the decision to come into work.
Oh, okay. Damn it.
That said, many people are excited to travel this summer, correct?
Correct.
Have you thought about all the people who make your vacation truly great? Maybe you go to a nice hotel. The concierge knows the best place to eat. Maybe you got a tour guide. Maybe somebody's, I don't know, renting you a one of those ski zip. What are those ski? I don't know. What are those things called? Water skis.
Yeah.
I don't know. You get something at the gift shop from the clerk. Well, I went on vacation. This is the T-shirt I got or whatever it is. Outstanding talent is crucial for a successful business. And if you're hiring, you can find talent for roles like these and more at ZipRecruiter when you try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. We've been advertising for ZipRecruiter, I don't know, for 5 or 6 years now, I think. And when it came time to hire Brendan's role, I went on ZipRecruiter. It was an incredible experience because I was very intimidated by the whole process, and it made it super easy. I had a bunch of different candidates who were great. I interviewed a ton of them. ZipRecruiter went out, pulled Brendan in, and he was perfect for the job. Brendan is how we got Bradley, and so on and so on. One great hire that ZipRecruiter did, and it made it very, very easy. So travel to this easy-to-remember web destination, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's where you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, ZipRecruiter. It is the smartest way to hire. Also, today's program, sponsored by same company that has provided me this for today. I know I am. I'm off my immunity boosting kick from Liquid IV.
You're back to the matcha.
Back to the matcha.
I should say, anecdotally, again, I was at a close friend's wedding this weekend, and she gave us some goodie bags. Guess what was in there?
Liquid IV?
Liquid IV.
Smart.
I know, right?
That is actually very smart.
Very smart.
One stick of Liquid IV, hydration multiplier, and 16 ounces of water hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. Liquid IV comes in a bunch of different flavors, like watermelon, which I sign off on, lemon lime, also sign off on, strawberry, I don't know. Strawberry, it's not for me, but pina colada, I know that sounds weird, but I love pina coladas. And then the matcha, of course, and the tangerine. I go right now, I'm just going back and forth, watermelon, tangerine, matcha. But I got to get back on that pina colada. Anyways, Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. That's why your friend's handing them out in gift bags
I know.
At your wedding.
And I'd already packed them, so I just had, like, I thought of it, and she thought of it. It was amazing.
You could maybe turn around and flip those, sell them at the wedding.
They were useful for some of my friends that were we were all staying together in the next morning, for sure.
You get three times the electrolytes with Liquid IV than you do from traditional sports drinks. It is made with premium ingredients, non-GMO, free from gluten, dairy, and soy. The science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. And also, they're on a mission to change the world. The company's donated over 20 million servings globally. Again, great for travel, great for post and pre-workouts. If you've been drinking too much, or for me, it's just like I want to stay hydrated, and this is the way I stay hydrated every day. I drink it during the show. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. It's 25% off anything when you use the promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today. liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITYREP. That's MAJORITYREP. Lastly, one out of three Americans report being sleep-deprived. I would be one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And their sheets could be the problem. Not so much for me anymore. I got about 40 other reasons why I stay up at night. But luckily, Cozy Earth provides the softest, most luxurious, and best temperature-regulating sheets. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's Most Favorite Things list for 4 years in a row. They are made from super soft viscose from bamboo. I don't know what viscose is.
I don't know.
Threads?
But yeah, I would imagine, yeah.
But it's made from bamboo, so they're sustainable. And here's the thing. Cozy Earth sheets, they breathe, so you sleep at night with the perfect temperature all year round. That is the key for me. We've talked about in the past, we had other sheets that we were supporting the show. We ended that relationship. We're looking for sheets that were soft, but also keep me cool because I cannot sleep hot. It has thousands of five-star reviews. It is no wonder the Cozy Earth sheets have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and podcast hosts like
that
myself.
Too.
Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial, which means you have up to 100 nights to sleep on it. You wash it, you try it out. If you're not completely in love, send it back for a full refund. There's a 10-year warranty, and Cozy Earth sheets come in four new colors. Check it out. For a limited time, save 35% on Cozy Earth bedding. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Enter my special promo code MAJORITY at checkout to save 35% now. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter MAJORITY at checkout for 35% off. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of American history at UCLA, about Juneteenth. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Joining us by phone, Professor Robin D.G. Kelly, Professor of American History at UCLA. Professor, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Yes, thanks. It's all great to talk to you, and apologies for the technical problem.
No worries. It's probably on our end. So let's, I was just saying beforehand, I was debating as to whether we should come into work for today on Juneteenth. And it's a new holiday, I guess officially made a federal holiday last year. There's many states, I think, still where you don't get the day off. Wanted to educate people about it. And, if you could, just give us in a nutshell, Juneteenth, what it celebrates, and then I want to talk about sort of the broader implications of it, and then also how it might relate to your work, which has been, and we've interviewed you for the story of Alabaman communists, black Alabaman communists trying to organize during the Depression era, and these ideas of how racism is so intricate to capitalism. But before we get there, let's start with just the remedial Juneteenth. What is it?
Right, exactly. So let me just confirm that this is an important day of work. It's not supposed to be a day of just relaxation, because in many ways, Juneteenth is declared a certain kind of freedom day. So let's give the background. The general story is that, in the state of Texas, African Americans allegedly were unaware that the Civil War was over, and that Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. This is not exactly true, by the way, but this is a part of the myth. And so basically on June 19th, 1865, after the Union forces had occupied Galveston, Texas, invaded and basically declared the war over, defeating the Confederacy there in the state of Texas, that's when Major General Granger read this proclamation that that slavery was over. That, again, I say this amidst, because Galveston was one of the major international port cities, had a significant working class, including a European working class, very much aware of what was happening around the globe. So it's not that people didn't know. It was that the Union forces weren't able to occupy Texas until that time. To go back to what it really represents, yes, it does represent in many ways what black Texans think of as the moment of emancipation. But what it was initially called was Jubilee Day. It wasn't called Juneteenth. And it was a reference to Leviticus chapter 25 of the Bible, which promised, in terms of Jubilee, it promised restitution of the land, that is, that the land shall revert to the original owner. It promises cancellation of all debts. It promised in Jubilee the freeing of all slaves and bond servants, right? So the presumption is that this biblical moment is a moment when all slaves are freed. And it's an expression of divine sovereignty, that is, that the true owners of the land, the land is God's land, right? So these celebrations were deeply religious, but deeply political. They held parades, picnics, performances, and these political gatherings were moments to talk about the right to vote for black people, the right to land, the right to some kind of reparations, the need to create political institutions for leadership. And that's what Juneteenth came to represent. And it was the promise of Reconstruction, which we know was overthrown and collapsed under the weight of Jim Crow. And in the 1930s, the Juneteenth celebrations came back, with a force. And it was tied to working class movements, in fact, in the 30s. As black people migrated out from Texas to places like California and throughout the Midwest and West Coast, they brought Juneteenth with them. Juneteenth is maybe a federal holiday, but it's not a new holiday for Black communities around the country, especially on the West Coast. It's not an accident, like the Poor People's Campaign in 68 held a Juneteenth solidarity rally in Washington, D.C., you know, in for the Poor People's Campaign. The Black Radical Congress, which I attended in 1998, we held the founding meeting on Juneteenth. So Juneteenth represents, you know, a day of struggle, a day of resistance, a recognition that the freedoms promised in the 13th Amendment, freedoms promised in the so-called Emancipation Proclamation, were just unfulfilled and was just a promise of liberation, not real freedom.
You know, that and I don't think I was aware, and I think we've probably done now, this is the fourth or fifth year in a row that we've had someone on to talk about Juneteenth. I don't know that I knew that it was called Jubilee, because I ran into this situation with my kid, actually, my 9-year-old, explaining Juneteenth as just sort of, I guess, the straightforward, this is when in Texas they were the last people to hear that the chattel slaves were freed, and it was his reaction of like, yeah, that was a good thing, and now that's over. Where it sort of like feels like, well, actually, nah, I mean, it's a little more complicated than that. And it did occur to me, and I don't want to be, you know, I mean, this is maybe a little bit cynical, but this is when I contemplate our holidays, like Independence Day. Well, that was a one-time event, and it fundamentally shifted the dynamic of, you know, what America was. But like the Memorial Days, you know, we don't really spend, I think, the time that we should contemplating these things. Mm-hmm. But at least there's an opportunity to do that. On some level, like celebrating the end of chattel slavery sort of feels like it sort of like tries to put things in a box and sort of, I don't know, say, well, we finished that and that's that.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what it does. It puts it in a box as if somehow it's passed, but it does something else too. And that is that the narrative, and even coming from decent liberals and some leftists, the narrative is skewed because it does two things that are really problematic. One, it presents the Emancipation Proclamation as the thing that ended slavery, when we know that it was just a wartime document, basically, that did not apply to 450,000 enslaved people in Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, in Tennessee. It didn't apply to places that were loyal to the Union. And not only that, but it only applied to the Confederate states. And unless the Union Army was there to emancipate people, they were still enslaved. So the fact of the matter is that enslaved people freed themselves. When Union troops started to enter into Confederate territory and win battles, Black people flocked to Union lines because they knew they could get protection there. They freed themselves. They undermined the Confederacy. That's a story we don't tell. Then what ends up happening is that the Emancipation Proclamation becomes a great document. The 13th Amendment just drops out, you know, altogether. And so that's part of the story. The other part of the story is, you know, when we talk about the history of Texas, Texas is tricky. Texas is the only state that started out as an independent, started out as part of Mexico, then became an independent republic for the purposes of keeping slaves when Mexico had abolished slavery in 1827, and then was annexed, but was annexed and became a state as a result of war, when the U.S. waged war with Mexico and took Texas, California, Nevada, New Mexico, and all those other places, right? So this is the result that Texas was one of these states designed to be a safe haven for slavery. So during the Civil War, after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued and some Confederate states were losing, what did the slaveholders do? They flocked to Texas. They took their enslaved people and crossed the 180,000 enslaved people were brought into Texas. And you don't think that those people who knew and passed on information about the Emancipation Proclamation didn't know that this thing had been issued? Of course they did. This is why they knew they were leaving. And so that's the moment where a number of those who could escape, black people could escape, they fled south to Mexico. They didn't flee north. There was no place to go. And so by the time Union troops showed up to retake Galveston, because by the way, I should mention that Galveston was occupied by Union forces in 1862 for several months until January 1st, 1863, the day the Emancipation Proclamation was supposed to be implemented, they were defeated by the Confederacy. Mm. So this myth of like people not knowing is dangerous, and it also takes away the agency from enslaved people who were the forces that destroyed the Confederacy in the first place.
What's your reaction to, I mean, you mentioned Texas, and that's what made me think of this. This Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday against the backdrop of a mass conservative movement to rewrite history in the form of these anti-critical race theory bills. Because, you know, I'm reminded of almost the way that Reagan was the president who mm-hmm. implemented MLK Day, right? And it saps it and almost, you know, papers over the struggle and the meaning behind it. There's a dichotomy there that I think is a little troubling because there's no real reckoning with the fact that history is being rewritten as we speak.
Right. No, that's a really good point. In fact, there's one slight difference between, say, a conservative Reagan overseeing King's holiday versus someone who's perceived to be, right, that's the Biden-Harris administration, perceived to be liberal pushing back against a right-wing wave. So this is what it appears to be, and I'll tell you what it really is. So it appears to be that this holiday is a bulwark against, right, the wave of anti-so-called CRT CRT pedagogy, right? In other words, that this is the bulwark against the right-wing attack on history, when in fact, it in some ways masks that attack. And let me explain what I mean. It's easy for the Biden administration and all of its friends to say, you know, we're against the criminalizing of teaching of anything considered to be quote-unquote divisive. We're against the attacks on critical race theory, which is not really critical race theory, it's just liberal multiculturalism. And we can prove it because we support this holiday. And so what you're going to see is right-wingers saying this holiday is a travesty. You're not allowed to teach about Juneteenth or emancipation or any of that stuff. And so we end up imagining that that the liberal wing is our best hope, when in fact we've been spending years pushing back against a certain kind of liberal erasure of this history. The liberal erasure is the one that says Lincoln freed the slaves, President Johnson gave us a civil rights bill. The kind of working class grassroots struggles that made these things possible are erased. But there's another side to the story, something I've been harping on, is that all these conservatives who are trying to outlaw what is essentially an anti-racist curriculum, right, because they say their children will feel uncomfortable, are not willing at the same time to outlaw racist curriculum. That is to say, no one's talking about removing Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia or John C. Calhoun, or Edmund Ruffin, or all these like pro-slavery writings from libraries or from teaching. You know, that's like the other side, right? In fact, these same people who are against anti-racist histories are the same ones who would argue that, you know, like the 13th and 14th Amendment, that was kind of legislative overreach.
Yeah.
They're the same ones who say that. So we're in a real hard struggle right now, and my fear is that if we fall into the trap of saying that what we need are simply more federal holidays that could celebrate the unity of this nation rather than the history of its problematic and racist past, something that could bring us together rather than understand why, what the consequences for the defeat of Reconstruction were. You know, something that could help us really understand, you know, why is it that 10 black people get shot down in Buffalo and how that's related to Reconstruction. That's what we need to know. We don't need to sort of make the case that, see, America's, you know, moral arc bends towards justice.
Mm.
And we know that in time we're going to prevail. And that's the lesson. That's not the lesson.
That, I mean, I have to say, and I thought, you know, part of it was just sort of, I have become so just interested in Reconstruction. I was like, maybe it would have been better to have a holiday to commemorate, you know, the coup in South Carolina during Reconstruction, essentially, you know, or... you know, massacres.
Any of the bombings of churches, of black churches. Yeah, right.
I mean, just the, you know, something that would bring about that history because, yes, we all know chattel slavery ended. Like, okay, we get it. But that did not solve the fundamental problems. And with that said, at the very least, having a holiday called Juneteenth allows us to have these type of conversations and examine it. So it's doing some of the work, I guess, that we
right,
would
right.
want.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, you know, it does the work. And actually, if we do it right, it can do the, to me, this is just my own take, to me, Juneteenth is an opportunity, if we do it right, to raise these issues in a more powerful way. My concern about commemorating these acts of violence is that it could possibly fall back into the same liberal trap, and that is to show the kind of history of victimization and that we've been able to overcome it. But here's the strength of Juneteenth. And it's so funny because I'm supposed to be giving a talk about it in the next couple hours in Pasadena, right? And Juneteenth, I treat Juneteenth not as the end of slavery, but the beginnings of a new war for Reconstruction. That's how we treat. So if you think of Juneteenth as the beginnings of the fight for freedom, not the end of slavery, but the beginnings of the fight for freedom, then we have to deal with what comes next. And that is why I remind us that the original name was the Day of Jubilee. Because Jubilee wasn't about the celebration of the end of the nightmare of slavery. These were political meetings every year on June 19th and gatherings that said, what are we going to do to preserve our freedom? What are we going to do to turn our liberation into actual freedom? What's our next steps? And that's why Jubilee made these claims, these arguments, claims for reparations, claims to redistribute land. And that, you know, one could extend that as well to include indigenous people. Because one of the stories about Texas is that, you know, I'm sure you might know about the Salt Creek Massacre, as it was called. And this is in Texas, 1871, when some of the Plains Indians were, you know, again, trying to come back, get their land back. And they waged an attack, you know, against settlers. The great general, and I say this, you know, tongue-in-cheek, the great General William T. Sherman, who's known for redistributing land to black people in South Carolina, you know, during Civil War, he's heroic in that sense, who also has a history as one of the most vicious, merciless killers of indigenous people, actually used the so-called Salt Creek Massacre as justification to wage one of the most vicious wars on Native peoples in Texas and throughout the South. And so in many ways, the post the moment of seeking freedom after that day of Juneteenth, the day of June 19th, led to this, opened up the door for this massacre by the same Reconstruction general who's heroic, you know, to basically, you know, murder Native peoples. And he had a lot of practice at it, by the way, you know, in the Seminole Wars and whatnot. But the main point here is that we can take Juneteenth as an unfulfilled promise. Juneteenth is the opportunity to talk about reparations. Juneteenth is the opportunity to talk about decolonization. It's the opportunity to talk about the violence that was meted out, that was, that we've had inherited, including the January 6th rebellion. January 6th dates back to the failure of Reconstruction, because you mentioned the coup in Wilmington, North Carolina. Well, there was a coup in Grimes County, Texas, very similar to what happened in Wilmington, where the, a group called, calling themselves the White Man's Union, as if, you know, you needed any clarification of what they represented. The White Man's Union, led by Democrats, literally went to the seat of Grimes County and killed all the elected officials who were populist, black and white, and took over the government. That's the legacy of the defeat of Reconstruction, the defeat of Jubilee, the defeat of Juneteenth, right? That's the story that we need to tell, rather than just, oh, these poor black people didn't know, have a clue about what was happening. And thank goodness for the Union, thank goodness for the military who told them they were free. That's not the narrative.
And I should say that I've read where you, maybe I think it was last year, you wrote about applying those, that same dynamic about Juneteenth and the concept of Jubilee also to on behalf of the Palestinian people as well. Mm-hmm. Who are subject to their own, we have a similar dynamic in terms of like indigenous exploited and dispossessed people amongst right. The Palestinians. Let's just broaden this conversation just a little bit in terms of your ideas about racism and its relationship to capitalism, because I think this is, you know, when you talk about everything that, I guess, continues on from that mm-hmm. that day from Juneteenth, this plays a big part.
Right, definitely. Well, there's many ways I can enter into that. I mean, the if there's a lesson here that could link the question of capitalism, racism, and Juneteenth, is very simple that, you know, we have to understand the history of capitalism in its current iteration as being rooted in the very systems of oppression that preceded capitalism, which includes racism and includes patriarchy, gender oppression. And so in many ways, when we think about, for example, just some obvious examples for right now, the commercialization of Juneteenth, the Juneteenth sales and things like that. That's the most crass example of the way in which black suffering and exploitation, extraction, becomes once again repackaged, recommodified, so people could either buy themselves a little bit of peace of mind to say that, you know, I've contributed something to the people whose wealth I was able to exploit. There's also the question of the current struggle for reparations and understanding what were the systems that led to this massive wealth extraction. Slavery is an obvious one. You know, you have unrequited labor that created wealth. And when I say wealth, I mean wealth not just for, like, I'm not talking about the working class or poor white people. I'm talking about from railroad companies to big agriculture to shipping to insurance. I mean, that's where the wealth accumulated. But then you move into the area, the period of Jim Crow, and how housing policies and segregation also led to transfer of wealth. A study done in California, 2014, showed that in just an LA metropolitan area right now, the wealth gap is, you know, in terms of wealth, African Americans have like $200 worth of wealth, median wealth, versus whites have $110,000. That's not all slavery. Some of it's about the fact that if you live in certain neighborhoods, the value of your property goes up. That value goes up because of federal and state policies that determine value, and real estate industry determine value based on race. That's an old practice and still happening today. So people are losing money all the time, and that money is being transferred, let alone the use of regressive taxation, which goes on to this day, where you got poor people, many of whom are black and brown, who pay sales taxes and pay all these kinds of taxes, whereas tax breaks are happening with corporate America and with property owners in many ways. And so the kind of, and then at the same time, those same communities that pay this regressive tax are not getting the benefits of their tax money. They're dealing with defunded schools, right. The lack of, you know, services in the communities, and there's a whole range of things that are going on. And that's just examples from today, let alone the historical examples we could talk about.
Well, you know, the one of the arguments that you make, broadly speaking, you know, to generalize, of course, you know, sort of across your writing is that for capitalism to exist, you need to have some type of like I guess structure of thinking where you can exploit, which is inherent to capitalism, you can exploit other people. If they are not quite people in the way that you're a person, like if they're somehow less, like that dynamic, because I'm sort of fascinated by this because on some level, like that's also how feudalism worked too. Right. I mean, you know, and I would imagine, I'm not even sure what we call, you know, the period of late antiquity or, you know, early history when we're talking about Philistines and you know, that era. But presumably for, you know, in the context of indigenous folk in this country, you know, sometimes the way that they refer to themselves as people and other groups are not people. Like that dynamic seems to have always been the case with humanity of othering people from whom you want to take things. And the othering has to start. But capitalism is just like, is a continuance of that. Explain that, and also how capitalism sort of reproduces that racism and that in our instance, white privilege, or, you know, Eddie Gloud calls it the value gap. There's a lot of different sort of terms for it. How does capitalism reproduce that so as to maintain this dynamic where you can justify exploiting other people?
Right. No, that's a good point. And this is a lesson I learned from my late teacher, Cedric Robinson, who wrote about, he wasn't the first one to introduce the concept of racial capitalism, but he emphasized in his book, Black Marxism, published back in 1983, that it's exactly what you said, that capitalism emerges within a particular civilization, that is in Europe, in which difference was used for millennia to justify or to structure, I should say, you know, the value of people, their ability, their place in the world, and their place in production. So, for example, you know, you mentioned feudalism. I mean, you know, anti-Semitism, for example, is another way in which, you know, whole group of people get placed within a particular hierarchy. So basically what this means is that capitalism emerges within a regime that's already racial and already gendered. This is not to say that the concepts of race don't change, because they do change. And in fact, the 18th century becomes scientific racism. And in certain groups of people who are considered divided, like, you know, the Irish were considered lower orders than the English, they begin to consolidate in this category called whiteness, you know. And Irishness doesn't disappear, but its devaluation disappears over time. And so these systems of difference are always dynamic. And of course, it's a gendered regime in which women's labor or anyone identified as woman or feminized end up being devalued as well, which allows for increased extraction of value. So when you talk about, when you ask the question about how does it continue, you know, one of the big tragedies of the system of racial capitalism is the way that it captures a segment of the white working class, you know, and actually it ties its identity to race, that is whiteness, and to masculinity, that is manliness. And so what ends up happening is that too many white working people see their value in whiteness and therefore see themselves as different from anyone who's not them, who's not white. And, you know, this is great quote by Cedric Robinson, where he says, you know, white patrimony deceives some of the majority of Americans, right? Patriotism and nationalism, others. But then he says the more fugitive reality was the theft they themselves endured in the voracious expropriation of others they facilitated. And the scrap, which was their reward, was the installation of black inferiority into their shared national culture. It's a paltry dividend, but it still serves. And that dividend is what Du Bois calls the wages of whiteness. That is, that they believe that one day they will become a CEO or a slaveholder if they work hard enough, that the material benefits are not just something that may happen, but supposed to happen, because it's their privilege, it's their entitlement. And then they see every day the institutional power and the violence of racism and racial violence against black, brown, and indigenous peoples. That's not to say, like, I don't want to be them. No. And that idea of differentiation is then reinforced by the state. But there are other elements to this, you know, as well. The most dangerous one for me is indifference, because, you know, yes, we can find all kinds of examples of white racism, but the indifference among white liberals, to me, is way more dangerous, because what ends up happening, I don't say more dangerous, but equally dangerous, because they end up actually accepting the fact that racism's racism. It's really tragic. I'm not one of them, but, you know, it's unfortunately anti-blackness will always keep black people down, and I just wish it were different, and they walk away. And they stand on the sidelines rather than insist that institutional racism is something that you have to fight and destroy in order to win the class war. And it's not something that you can eliminate through a workshop, through trainings. It's something that you have to fight for. And that is to say, anti-racism, ending patriarchy, ending transphobia, homophobia, these are all part of a class war to bring about the kind of vision that was embedded in Jubilee in the first place.
When you say, I mean, my perspective on the white liberal is that they are more inclined to at least identify or attempt or to as anti-racist than they are in seeing this as a inherent problem with capitalism.
Yes, that is true. I don't disagree with that. You know, but we have this other problem, I think, you know, which extends both to liberals and to some white radicals as well, and that is accepting the idea that anti-black racism, racism is a permanent condition that can't be changed. And that, or worse, worse than that, the idea that the only way to change it is by ending capitalism. And that would be a great, great idea if it were true, you know, because just like racism and gender inequalities and gender oppressions predated capitalism, it'll postdate it as well unless it's addressed.
Right. You know, I mean, let's talk about that, because that, I mean, that is the, I mean, to me, you know, within the sort of center to the left, that has been the, there are basically, you know, there are two broad positions that I've, you know, come across. One is that we need to fight racism without any regard for capitalism and how capitalism reproduces racism and perpetuates it and needs it. And then there, on the other end of the spectrum, there is we don't need to think about or we don't. There's nothing that we can do to address racism without getting rid of capitalism first. But if I understand your argument, is these are things that need to happen simultaneously.
Simultaneously all the time, you know, and you know, this idea of privileging race over class over race, to me never made sense, because you know, when you're in the middle of a fight, you fight the modes of oppression that you're dealing with. And for a lot of black people, indigenous people are fighting for land, and brown people, they're dealing with racism. In other words, the class expression, the way that class oppression is affecting them is through racism. You know, that's why Stuart Hall had this line about, you know, racism is the modality through which, you know, class exists, or, you know, how it operates. And so, you know, many ways, to me, it's not a debate. There are ways, though, in which fighting racism could reinforce capitalism if you're not careful. Like, for example, the idea that what we need are just, you know, more black cops, more black elected officials whose position might be completely reactionary.
Right.
You know, or that somehow black capitalism is a thing that's going to save us all. Of course, no one, anyone who's on the left, they don't believe that. And most black progressive or radicals don't believe that either. That's not the debate for me. But to say, for example, that the struggle in Ferguson around Mike Brown's murder wasn't anti-capitalist is to misunderstand what actually happened. I mean, you have people in the streets who are fighting a system in which the police extract wealth, right, and pay for itself through ticketing and fines. You know, and this is the thing that led to Mike Brown's murder in the first place. So they're out there fighting a system of rapacious capitalism expressed through the violence and fascism of police practice. And then people are saying, well, this is not about anti-capitalism. These are the same people out there fighting for $15 an hour as a minimum wage. Same people. So there's a way in which if we don't understand how the system's functioning, we're going to make the mistake of thinking that class struggle is the colorblind thing, you know, and anti-racism is the anti-class thing, and that's not actually how it functions. And this concept of racial capitalism will allow us to see better how these things function, you know, constitutively, right?
Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of American history at UCLA, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it, and happy Juneteenth. And
yes, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. All right, take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the show. Maybe I'll take a little IM from the chattering class before we go into the fun half.
A little I am?
Yeah, I'll take a little I am.
That's what Sam's been calling I am, is yeah. the chattering.
Chattering class.
He's trying to do cross politics. It's, yeah, exactly. It's going strange.
I just saw this from Daredevil. That's why it just caught my eye as it was going on there. How tall are you, Sam? No inflating your stats. We're taking bets in the chat.
Oh.
Yeah, that is Emma's. That's really your legacy. It's like there's a whole.
I've created gambling addicts.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate. I'm sorry.
If I'm wrong, I have to donate a $5 super chat.
Okay.
Emma, want in on these chat bets?
How tall is Sam? I mean, I probably have a better. This might be insider trading.
It might be a little bit. Take a guess. Let's see.
6'1".
6'1". Wow.
No?
Matt's laughing at that.
Yeah, no, he's not.
Wait, what? You're
Jesus, Matt.
He might be 6 foot.
Well, Matt's 6'3".
No, I'm 6'2". That's probably why you're.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm in between 5'8 and 5'9", and I thought you were at least 3 inches taller than me.
You know, that's 5'10". Amazing because people generally get it wrong. I am actually like 5'11" and like 3/4".
Ah, okay. Yeah.
So I basically say like Jewish 6 foot.
Yeah. That's okay. Right. Yeah. Round up.
That's right. I round up to 6 feet. I mean, it's closer than any other.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. I'm like 5'11.67".
How tall are you, Bradley?
I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
I'm five. I say 5'10", but my doctor told me I was 5'9¾".
Oh. You're shrinking.
Which is really emasculating to me. They couldn't round up.
I think 5'10" is sometimes like the that's when men are like, all right, average, right? That's what people say.
I think
many
so,
people
yeah.
are saying.
Well, I want to know what happened in the bet, and I know you do too, folks, and that's why you should join us in the fun half. You can find out. You can have fun in the fun half and find out huge things.
our metrics.
Yes.
Who won? Who won?
Maybe we'll
bet?
Even say our weight.
There we go.
No.
I haven't weighed myself in 10 years.
You haven't?
No, I guess I must have at the doctor's office, but yeah, I don't remember.
That's depressing.
Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the fun half free of commercials. You also get the fun half as well. So check it out. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that makes this show survive and thrive. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Do people drink coffee anymore?
I'm drinking some right now.
There you go. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You got to check out some of these. First off, Just Coffee was a co-op that was involved. They were giving out free coffee during the big protest now 11 years ago in Wisconsin. I went out there and visited, I don't know how many years ago this was now, 5 years ago, I guess, was at Just Coffee and heard about all the support that they give their growers. Chiapas region and other places in Central America, they do not abandon their growers. It is really impressive what they do to support the people that they buy the coffee from. It's all fair trade. The coffees are great. 10% off. You can also get the Majority Report blend. Or you can get Mark Maron's blend, whatever. But check it out, justcoffee.coop, COOP.
Does Maron still advertise it on his show?
You know what?
I'm
debating as to
know.
Whether I should pretend like I listen to Maron's show anymore.
I think you might have already revealed it.
I don't know. He's just he's you know, he's into the like realm of interviewing people that I'm sure are nice and this and that, but I'm just not, you know. And there's only so many times I can skip over Maron's introductions. I can only tell that so many times. I said that to his face on his TV show. When I appeared on his TV show and I ad-libbed it right in the middle of the scene. And
because you guys are arguing, right? And you're like, oh, you just talk about like bullshit or whatever.
Right, yeah, I can't remember exactly what it was that I said, but it was basically like I skipped through the intro like everybody does. And I heard his writers laugh when I said that.
It's been about 4 or 5 years since we had Maron on.
Has it? All right. Well, maybe I'll get him on. Well, now I can't. I got to get some distance between this and that. What's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe, Matt?
Last Friday, David and I were on Left Flank Vets, their Twitch feed, and their call-in show afterwards. And tonight, I am doing another media appearance on Ben Burgess's show to an advance of his going into the Lion's Den with Tulsi Gabbard, Tim Pool, and I think James O'Keefe.
It is James O'Keefe. I am familiar with that.
So we'll be talking to those guys.
Yeah.
Hmm. Let's see if I can say something that gets him disinvited or something.
It's weird. one person from the left, and then I get are they arguing that Tulsi Gabbard is
probably.
Yeah, she's a leftist.
Yeah,
she endorsed Bernie Sanders after all.
Whenever they put her on Fox News, they put the D in parentheses next to her name. They might as well just like circle it in red. Like, this is what we're trying to do.
They could add Brett Weinstein, and they could have three people who endorsed Bernie on it.
There you go.
And Joe Rogan.
Yeah, Joe Rogan, too.
On the left.
Oh, my gosh. I just reordered, Binder Dad says, I just reordered another 2-pound bag of MR blend. Then they suggested the WTF blend. I declined. That is, whoa. Mark was on last year, Matt, says two kids in a trench coat.
Oh, really? 2017 was the most recent that came up.
I can't remember. I
don't remember that. Yeah.
I don't recollect that at all. All right, folks. Oh, we'll talk about what happened with Colbert, because that impacts somebody who comes on the show regularly.
What happened with Colbert?
Oh, it's crew. Oh. Yeah. We'll talk about it in the fun half. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who? Fun. What is up, everyone? Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. And let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this...
7-8? Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? Oh, no sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3-8.
9-11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.